Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's featured speaker is noted reporter and author T.R. Reid. He spoke recently in Portland at an event sponsored by the Daniel Hanley Center for Health Leadership, the Aligning Forces for Quality Partnership, and the World Affairs Council of Maine. His presentation is titled National Healthcare Reform, Leveraging Opportunities for Maine. This program, along with the rest of the Speaking in Maine series, will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Clifford Gilpin, retired World Bank official and president of the World Affairs Council of Maine.
In introducing our speaker for this evening, I do have a personal story, which is that back in the early 90s, I was managing the health and education programs in Asia for the World Bank. And at that time, some of the emerging economies in places like Malaysia and Indonesia were beginning to think about how they could develop a more modern system of financing and insurance for healthcare. And they came to the bank and they said, "We want you to help us to advise us what to do." And we said, "Well, you know, this is a very complicated issue. There is frankly no answer, no one answer. There is no cookie cutter system. But what we can do is we can bring in people who can speak as experts from different countries to at least give you a sense of what are some of the experiences and some of the options that are out there." And so we organized a seminar for officials from a number of Asian countries, and we brought speakers from the United States. I recall that the speaker from the United States actually was Uwe Reinhardt, from Canada, from Germany, from the UK, and from Japan. And we basically said, these are some of the kinds of choices and trade-offs that you're going to be presented with as you think about this issue. So in being here tonight, I'm reminded of that experience. And it is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, T.R. Reid, who will talk to you about what Maine can learn from one man's global search for quality and affordable health care. Mr. Reid is an experienced writer and speaker. He is also a health policy fellow. He became one of the nation's best-known correspondents through his coverage of global affairs for the Washington Post. And his books and documentary films and his lighthearted commentaries on national public radio are well known. He majored in classics at Princeton and then served as a naval officer, a teacher, and various other jobs before joining the Washington Post, where he covered Congress and four presidential campaigns. He served as the paper's bureau chief in Tokyo and London. He's written and hosted documentary films for the National Geographic and PBS and other networks, and he has written a number of books, six in English and three in Japanese. His latest book, The Healing of America, which was published in the summer of 2009, was, of course, particularly timely because that was at the height of the debate in this country about the future of healthcare. He brings a refreshing outsider perspective, I think, to the healthcare debate, with the clear thinking and direct communication that characterizes his other writing to help Americans understand global issues. We can all agree that our current healthcare system is badly broken and that we have much to learn from other experiences about how we might fix it. Mr. Reid, I welcome you to the podium. Thank you.
I'm so pleased to be here, I'm telling you. To have a delightful, crisp, bright, down east winter day to come to Maine. Really, you've done great by me. It's been a while since I've been in Portland, but I pretty quickly got back in the groove. I wore my hiking boots, and I took a trek around this totally charming city. I saw Longfellow. I saw John Ford. I saw the mast of the USS Portland over at Fort Allen Park. And get this, for breakfast, I went to Becky's and had a lobster omelet. Lobster omelet. We don't have those in Colorado where I live, so that was pretty great. I just really like coming to Maine. It's a huge state with not that many people, and I think I just love the sense of regional pride, the sense of community in this state. We have some relatives in Brunswick, Maine. Every year at Christmas, they send us a fresh Maine pine wreath for Christmas, and they always sign the card the same way, "Love your Mainers," which I really like. It's quite touching. And I have an old friend, Jim Parmentier. I've known him forever, and he moved here 2 months ago. Was it 2 months ago, 3 months ago? And I just asked him, "Are you a Mainer?" And he said, "Maniac." And I get that. I like that. I do have one gripe about Maine, though, if you don't mind. I got one complaint. This year on October 22nd, Sunday River opened its slopes on October 22nd. That was 5 days before any resort in Colorado. And we don't allow this. No, we've got to be first in skiing. This is crucial in Colorado. They would yank my driver's license if I didn't say that. So, and I'm particularly pleased to be here because we're talking about health care, and it's true. Maine is recognized nationally as a leader in quality health care and improving the kind of care that Americans get and expanding coverage. You all have done a marvelous job on it. That's why we heard today Frank Johnson is going to Oregon at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning to explain to them how to improve health care quality, because the whole country is looking to Maine. And, you know, I can see why. If you were at this meeting today, just the passion for quality among the people at that meeting, this just desire to do better for their patients. I go to a lot of doctors' meetings. Usually they're complaining about insurance companies or Medicare reimbursement rates, and here I come to a meeting of doctors and hospital executives who are concerned, passionately concerned about improving quality for their patients. That was pretty inspiring. And if you think about it, that's kind of the tradition of Maine, going back to Dr. Dan Hanley, who really drove this state to improve quality and get costs under control, and I can see through the Hanley Center that inspiration is still there. You know, Dr. Jack Wenberg is here, and he says in his book, it's a terrific book, as somebody said, it'll make great Christmas giving, at a time when Jack Wenberg, whose ideas now are crucially important to our healthcare debate, but when he came up with these ideas 30-some years ago, they were pretty controversial. And Dan Hanley grabbed onto these ideas in Maine and really pushed them and really pushed the medical community here to do something. I'll tell you what happened. Here's what happened. So Jack Wenberg is a young doctor in Vermont. I can't remember. Was it White River Junction, whatever town in Vermont? And the kids come home, and the school doctor has said they need a tonsillectomy. And Jack is kind of a curious guy, so he checks up, and it turns out that that doctor recommends a tonsillectomy for 75% of all the kids in the town. Had he lived one town over where there was a different pediatrician, only 20% of the kids were recommended for tonsillectomies. And Jack, being a curious kind of guy, digs into this and comes up with the concept of variation and subsequently unwarranted variation, and how come we have all this churning going on? Doesn't this add to costs, and does it add anything to quality? This is a pretty controversial thing to say to doctors. And as a matter of fact, the administration at the University of Vermont hounded him out in Vermont. They didn't want to have this troublemaker, and Dr. Wenberg was forced to go down the road to another small college called Dartmouth, where he's worked ever since. But in Maine, Dr. Dan Hanley saw these findings. He realized that they applied in Maine, too. He wrote a really seminal editorial in the main medical journal saying, doggone it, we ought to pay attention to this. And Maine therefore became a leader in a cause in getting rid of this unwarranted variation that has now swept the country and is a key part of the Affordable Care Act of the 2010 health reform. So I think it all fits in place, and to see the inspiring stories of these people, these docs and nurses from Maine who went all over the world to help people, to me that's exactly in the Hanley tradition. It seems exactly right that they should get awards from the Hanley Center. And I enjoyed this session today because we did focus on what you're calling the Affordable Care Act. I was sitting at a table when they were talking about it, and a woman sitting at my table said, "What's this ACA? What's this ACA?" And I said, "Well, you're not allowed to use this word, but it's Obamacare, you know. In most of the country, that's what they call it. They don't like it, but they call it that." And as we heard today, the Affordable Care Act, or the 2010 health reform, really is, it's going to do a lot of good. It's going to get more people covered. It has a lot of steps, as we heard from Dr. Berenson, to improve quality, the kind of thing you're doing already. But I'm not too happy with this Health Reform Act because it just doesn't get us where we ought to get. For all the changes and all the $940 billion over 10 years, et cetera, it still doesn't get us to universal coverage at reasonable cost. And it seems to me that ought to be the goal for a rich country. Thanks. Yep. It's supposed to expand coverage by 32 million people. That would be a good thing. I have a feeling we're not going to get there because the Republicans who now run the House of Representatives are not going to appropriate the money. So I don't even think we'll get the 32 million. But even if it worked, Obamacare would still leave 25 million Americans uninsured 10 years from now. That's just not acceptable because those Americans without insurance tend to die of treatable diseases because they can't see a doctor. Do you know this? The Institute of Medicine says 25,000 of our fellow citizens die every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford a doctor. In the richest country in the world, we let that happen. They go bankrupt at huge rates. So we're just not there yet. We're not to the goal. But you know what? I am totally confident that we could get to the destination. I know that our country could get to universal coverage at reasonable cost. And the reason I know that is because all the other countries like us, and I mean by that rich, high-tech, advanced, industrialized, free market democracies, all of them provide coverage for everybody. And they do it for, on average, about half as much as we spend. That is, they get much more medicine quite often. They get better results, and they spend a lot less. So how do you do that? How do you cover everybody and spend half as much? Well, the reason I'm here tonight is I got interested in that question just as a reporter. Just how do they do that? And I went around the world and wrote a book and made a couple of films trying to figure out how they do that. And what's going to happen tonight is, they didn't give me much time, but it's in a very fast way, I'm going to take you on a whirlwind tour around the world, and we'll see how these other rich countries manage to cover everybody and spend half as much as we do. How do you do that? And you know, I don't have any axe to grind for any of these countries. I don't care whether one system or another looks good or looks bad. So I'll tell you what's good and what's bad in all these systems. I'm going to try to be just a really frank, objective reporter. And since we're being frank and totally upfront here, I think I'll also tell you my hidden agenda, the real reason for this lecture. So my hope is, as I said, I got to race through this. They didn't give me any time. What I hope is that you'll hear this very quick tour of the world and you'll say, gee, that was really interesting stuff. I wonder if there's a book I could buy about that. Christmas is coming, you know, so. But I tell you what, before we do that, I'll tell you what I didn't find when I went around the world, because in many ways that's just as interesting for Americans as what I did. So you ready? Guess what? it's not all socialized medicine out there. In fact, a lot of rich countries cover everybody with private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance. In about 5 minutes, I'm going to argue to you that many countries are less socialized than the United States when it comes to medicine. I didn't find a perfect system. Every country's healthcare system is struggling with the high cost of modern medicine. No country can afford to cover everything that modern medicine can do, including the United States. And the result is all countries ration care. Rationing care is a bad word, we know that. But the United States does it every single day, and all countries have to. No system is perfect. Guess what? They're not all single payer. I did see government-run single-payer systems that work pretty well, but a lot of multi-payer systems work fine. Germany has 220 different payers. Switzerland is a country about the size of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire combined, and 70 different payers. Japan is astonishing, 3,200 different payers, but it works fine. And then we heard a lot of talk today. For those of you who were here earlier, we heard a lot of conversation about how we got to change the payment mechanism of American medicine. You know, we have this fee-for-service system where the doctor gets paid for every shot she gives, every scan she orders, so she tends to give more shots and order more scans. You've heard this. The interesting thing is almost all the countries I went to have the fee-for-service system. There are a few that don't, but most do. And yet they manage to control costs pretty well, even with fee-for-service, which kind of runs contrary to what we heard today. I mean, the world champion at controlling costs, in my view, is Japan. This is an astonishing country in health terms. I don't know if you know this. They have the oldest population in the world, and they have the healthiest population in the world. You think about it, those two shouldn't go together. And they love, just as a cultural matter, they love going to the doctor. They're the world's biggest consumers of health care. On average, the Japanese go to the doctor 15 times a year. We go about 4.8. In America, the average hospital stay is 5.5 days. In Japan, it's 20. In Japan, when a new baby is born, on average, mother and child stay in the hospital 10 days after the birth. This is normal. Twice as many prescriptions per capita, 3 times as many MRI scans, and get this, they spend $3,400 per person per year on health care and cover everybody. We spend $7,500 and leave $50 million uncovered. I mean, to me, that's cost control. And as I said, they like going to the doctor. I saw this joke. I used to watch, when I lived in Japan, I used to watch NHK, which is their BBC. It's the big public broadcaster. And, you know, I don't know how many of you know Japanese people, but they're serious, earnest, hardworking people. They study all the time. And so NHK, their national network, predictably, most of the day, it's very serious documentaries about the Inuit or some, you know, something like that. And but if you stay up late enough, at about 12 or 12:30 at night, NHK lets the comedians come on, right? And so one night about 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching NHK, and on comes this comedian sketch. And what it is it's three old guys like Tanaka and Fujisaki and Watanabe. And they're sitting around having their morning coffee, and it's very clear that these three guys have coffee together every morning. And then the camera kind of pans back, and we can see that the place they have their morning coffee is in the doctor's waiting room. Because they go to the doctor every day. The out-of-pocket, the copay is $3. You know, why not? Oh, doctor, my earlobe hurts kind of thing, you know. And Tanaka says to Watanabe, he says, wait a minute, where's Honda-san? Where's Honda-san? How come he's not here today? And the answer is, oh, Honda's homesick. He couldn't go to the doctor today. They really like going to the doctor, but they control costs pretty well. So what I'm getting at is fee-for-service works. It doesn't have to be single-payer, although those systems work. So here's what we'll do. Very quickly, I'm going to run through what I found when I went around the world. And the good news for you and the good news for my publisher who paid for all this is that You don't have to go to all 200 countries in the world to see how this happens. You don't even have to go to all the 35 or 40 rich countries, because it turns out healthcare systems kind of fall into categories. And in my study, in my book, I list four models of healthcare, and with variations, all the countries in the world fall into these four models. So here's what we'll do. We'll race very quickly through the four models, and pay attention, because after each one, I'm going to give you a quiz, okay? So we're going to start in Great Britain, and we're going to start with the beverage model of healthcare. And this is named for this gentleman, Lord William Beveridge, who was kind of a classic British type. Lord Beveridge was a landed gentry. He was born to a huge wealth. There goes my speech. Born in a huge mansion. He was born with the title Lord. He was born to a seat in the House of Lords. He had it made from day one. And, some of these titled gentry in Brit turn out to be dissolute drug addicts and drunks, you know, and they make a living by selling tours through the old mansion or something. But some of them are different, and Lord Beveridge was one of these types. And here's what he did. The day he graduated from Oxford in 1902, I think it was, he went down to the streets of East London, and he devoted his life to helping poor people. He didn't have to, but this is what he chose to do. And he became a famous social reformer. He invented a lot of the stuff that we think of today as kind of standard part of a decent society. For example, in 1904, he noticed that these kids down on the streets of East London, many of them never got a decent meal in their life. There was just no food in the home. And so he invented the school cafeteria. He invented the notion that they should provide at least one warm meal, either breakfast or lunch, for the kids in school. So they got one warm meal a day. Today, that's absolutely standard everywhere in the rich world, but it was his idea. And as I say, he became a really famous social reformer on both sides of the Atlantic. And here's what happened. Towards the end of World War II, when it became clear that the U.S. and the U.K. were going to defeat the Nazis, Britain was going to survive as an independent nation, which had not been clear at all in 1939 and 40. But as it became clear that our side was going to win, Winston Churchill, the prime minister, started thinking about what Britain should look like after the war. What should Britain be in the second half of the 20th century? He was a statesman. He tended to look ahead. And he set up all these blue ribbon committees to plan this, and he appointed the great Lord Beveridge to write a report on social services in Britain in the second half of the 20th century. And Britain and Beveridge published this famous report, huge bestseller in Europe and the U.S., setting up social services. And the key part of it was the Beveridge Plan for Healthcare. And under the Beveridge Plan for Healthcare, taking care of people's health is government's job. It's like running the parks or paving the streets, picking up the garbage or public library. It's a service you get when you need it, and you don't pay a bill. I mean, they pay. They pay high taxes. The sales tax on everything in Britain on January 1st goes to 20%. They pay, but you don't pay a medical bill. 98% of the people in Britain go their whole life and never get a doctor bill, never get a hospital bill. As it says up there, you never pay an insurance premium. There's no copay. There's no deductible. There's no nothing. Because providing health care is government's job. In the Beveridge model, government owns the hospitals. Government employs the specialist doctors who work in hospitals. Government runs the lab, employs the lab technicians. The family docs are private business people. They're private doctors, but they only bill the National Health Service. They only bill the government. So government provides the care, and government pays for the care, and this model works. I mean, it gives that the system, the National Health Service, a lot of power, a lot of control. For example, as you all know, one of the problems in our country is we're not turning out enough primary care doctors. Too many of our young docs want to become specialists. We have too many of them and not enough primary care docs. What, 35% of American doctors are primary care doctors? In Britain, 64% of the doctors are primary care. The NHS wanted more primary care doctors, and would you like to know how they got them? in I don't know if any of you saw the movie we made where I went around the world and we saw my GP, Dr. Badat, the guy with the 52-inch waist. He's a family doctor just down the street from our house in London. He makes twice as much as a cardiac surgeon. You do that and you get more primary care doctors. And you can do that if you run the system. And that's why these systems, beverage model systems, tend to work. And they're used in a lot of places. Let's see, Britain, of course, Ireland, Spain, Italy, most of Scandinavia, New Zealand. Cuba is a classic case of the beverage model. It works pretty well. But here's my question for you. If government provides the care and government pays for the care, would you call that socialized medicine? What do you think? Is that socialized medicine? Yeah, I'd say so. To me, I'd describe that as socialized medicine. Now, here's the deal. I give a lot of talks around the country, and Americans don't know what socialized medicine means, right? We know it's bad, but we don't know what it means. But I think this model, the beverage model, definitely is socialized medicine. It works pretty well. You take Britain, for example. They cover everybody. They have a slightly longer life expectancy, better recovery rates from most, not all, but most major diseases, and they spend half as much per capita as we do. It's a beverage model. It works. But now, that's socialized medicine. We agree on that, right? But now let's jump across to the mainland of Europe, and we're going to see the mirror image of the beverage model. And this one, named for another great European, this is called the Bismarck model, named for Otto von Bismarck. He was the first chancellor of Germany. What happened is in 1871, he was the chancellor of Prussia, which was sort of northeast Germany and Poland today, his capital in Berlin. And he, through a series of wars and a lot of money, he unified about 25 German-speaking principalities and fiefdoms into a new nation, Deutschland, or Germany. And I think you can see, this is the Prussian general with his spiked helmet. Does he look like a kind of welfare state softy to you? I mean, warm and fuzzy kind of guy. But here was his problem in the 1870s and 80s. He had to convince these new Germans, and there were, you know, Bavarians and Frankfurters and Liechtensteiners and Alsatians, that they now belonged to a new nation and that they owed allegiance to a new national government based in Berlin. Not an easy thing to do. And tough guy Bismarck, you know what he did? He invented the welfare state. He invented the idea that a central government should provide benefits to people all over the country and therefore build up a loyalty to the capital. For example, in 1873, Bismarck decided that the government in Berlin should send old age pension checks to all people after they retired from the farm or the factory. We call that Social Security. We got around to it in 1935, but it was his idea. He did a lot of other stuff like that. And in 1883, Bismarck decided that a rich, successful country should provide health care to all its citizens. Why did he do that? Well, partly, as I said, he was trying to build allegiance to this new government. He needed a healthy workforce for the newly industrialized Germany. He needed healthy young people to man his army. It's the biggest, strongest army in Europe. But Bismarck, you know, he was a Republican. I mean, what we would call a Republican. He was pro-business. He hated taxes. But and when he said we're going to provide health care for everybody, his Republican conservative allies rejected this. No, the rich people get health care. We don't have to do that. And Bismarck said, well, I think we should think about it as applied Christianity. Let's care for the least of our brethren. That's what he said. This tough-looking soldier here. But, as I said, he didn't like big government. He didn't like taxes. So here's how he did it. Bismarck set up a model where everybody gets insurance from private insurance companies. They're called Krankenkasse sickness funds. You buy the insurance through your employer. The employer and the employees split the premium. And then you go to private doctors and private hospitals, and the private insurance pays the bill. Are you with me on this? Private docs, private hospitals, private insurance companies. As I said, in Germany today, there are 220 of these insurance plans. This is universal coverage. It's not socialism. These are private plans. So here's my next quiz question. The Bismarck model of healthcare, where the docs are private, the labs are private, the drug companies are private, the hospitals are private and or charity, and the insurance is private, would you call that socialized medicine? No. The answer is no. I don't think it is. In fact, in Germany, they don't have a Medicare. People stay with the private insurer cradle to grave. They don't have this system where you switch to government-run health care at age 65. So I argue in my book that this Bismarck model is less socialized than the United States of America. So if people say to you, oh, covering everybody, that's big government nanny state socialism, no. The answer is no. You can do it in the private sector. And this model works, too. It works very well. It's used, in Switzerland, Netherlands, Belgium, France to a degree, Japan. In my book, I call Japan Bismarck on rice. And in the United States, 150 million Americans are on the Bismarck model of health care, going to private doctors and paying through private insurance that they share with their employer. It's fine, and it's universal coverage, but not socialized medicine. So that's two models. Now, the third model I'm going to tell you is kind of a blend of the two. In the third model, the providers, the docs, the hospitals, the labs are private, but the payment scheme is government. And do you know where that was invented? This is the paradigm case of national health insurance is Canada. This system where everybody pays to a government health insurance plan and then you go to private doctors and the government system pays the bill. This was invented in 1944 by this great guy, Tommy Douglas. He was the governor, they call him premier up there, of Saskatchewan out west. And he was a socialist. He was an open socialist. And he ran for governor as a socialist on the promise that he would provide health care for everybody in Saskatchewan. In the midst of the Depression, this was a pretty shocking notion. And here's how he did it. He set up a system where everybody is covered by the government. You're required to pay to the government system every month. And then you go to the doctor, and basically it's free. The system pays. Some provinces in Canada now have a copay, but many of them, Saskatchewan still does not. Tommy Douglas was a very good politician. He was elected, I think, six times as the socialist governor of this pretty conservative western state. So here's the deal. Under this model, you have to pay the premium to the government health insurance system, right? You have to pay. It's withheld from your pay. The money goes to the government, and if you don't pay, you go to jail. But guess what? It's not a tax. He never called it a tax, because if you call it a tax, then it's going to wasteful bureaucrats, right? He always called it a premium, because if people pay a premium, they figure they're buying a product, they're buying insurance. So it's always been a premium. And in the same way, Tommy Douglas came up with a very clever name for his health insurance plan. Do you know what he called it? You probably do, your neighbors. Medicare. He called it Medicare. He came up with that name in 1944. And sure enough, in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson decided that all seniors in the United States should have health insurance, he took the name and the model from Canada. At the moment, 46 million Americans are on this system of care. They go to private doctors, and a government health insurance scheme pays the bill, or at least most of the bill, or some of the bill, depends on your doctor. And this model works fine. It's used, in Canada, it's used in Taiwan, it's used in South Korea. Some Latin American countries have a variant of it. And as I said, 46 million Americans are on it. But I don't know, have you heard those horror stories about long waiting times in Canada? You know what? I think they're true. They really do, for economic reasons largely, to save money. The Canadians have decided that they're going to provide all the acute care you need. If you're seriously ill, they'll treat you. But if your problem is that your knee hurts or your back hurts or your shoulder doesn't move like mine, you wait. They've limited the number of operating rooms. They've limited the number of surgeons. They've limited the number of scanning machines. So everybody waits, and this is a way to save money. When I was in Canada, I spent a lot of time with a wonderful, wonderful family doctor in Saskatoon. And after a while with him, I really liked him. I said, hey, doc, look, I broke my shoulder in the Navy. It only goes this high. It hurts every morning when I wake up. What can I do? And he said, it's a gatekeeper system. You got to go to the GP first to get a reference to the specialist, just like many insurance plans in America. He said, yeah, you need an orthopedic specialist. You need an orthopedic surgeon. But there's a really good orthopod down the street. I'll write you a letter and recommend you, and you can go down there. That's good news. How long will it take? 10 or 12 months. 12 months. 12 months. It hurts every day when I wake up. I don't want to wait 12 months for care. He said, oh, I didn't say care. No, it'll be 12 months for the initial consultation. It'll be weeks after that if he wants to do anything for you. That's what the Canadians have done because they're saving money, but it's not a function of the model. Australia has the national health insurance model, exactly the same model, and Australia has shorter waiting times for all medical procedures than the United States. So it's not the model that keeps people waiting. It's just the decision they made in Canada. So I've now given you the three systems found in rich countries. The fourth model I'm going to tell you about is the most common model in the world because it's found in all the countries that can afford to provide health care, which is about 150 of the 200 countries on Earth. In these poor countries where people make $1 a day or $2 a day, food and clothing are tough enough. Health care is a luxury. And so in those countries, where's my clicker? Here it is. The model is called the out-of-pocket model. It's just what it says. If you have some money in your pocket and your child is sick, you can take her to the doctor and pay him and she'll be treated. If you have no money, your kid stays sick or she dies. That's it. Simple, brutal. It's the fact of life for most people on Earth. Some countries have a big public hospitals in the big city. You can line up and get free care. When I was in India, in Delhi, outside the hospital in Delhi, I met a guy who was standing there in the rain. He kind of made a handheld tent out of old canvas cement bags that he found on the street. And he'd been waiting there 4 days and had about 2 days to go before he could get in to see the doctor. But it would be free if he got in. But if you live in a village or nowhere near the big city, then you either pay out of pocket or you don't get care. If you don't have money, pay in something else. I went to a clinic in Nepal, way up on a hillside. Up in northern Nepal, there are no roads. You hike everywhere. I hiked about 2 or 2.5 hours up this steep hill, and at the top is this squat little stucco building, like a garden shed or something, plainest building you've ever seen, except all the walls were a different color. So what's going on? I'm inside talking to the doctor. I said, do your patients pay you? He said, well, hardly anybody has any money. They pay me with what they've got. Like what? And he says, well, I eat a lot of potatoes. That's the staple crop up there, right? And he says, every once in a while, somebody says to him, doctor, thanks for treating my child. I don't have any money to pay you, but I do have some paint at home. So I'll hike home and come back and paint your clinic. And, of course, they all have a different color. So that's the out-of-pocket model. It's the most common model in the world. And as I said, I spent a year or two traveling the world to find these four models. It cost my publisher, Penguin, a lot of money, and then I made two movies for PBS Frontline on this same project. So PBS paid for it, and you know PBS is paid for by viewers like you. So I thank you. But here's the big secret. And I don't want you to tell the accountants at Frontline or Penguin Press this fact, but guess what? I could have seen them all. I could have seen all the models and never left home. because we've got them all. Right here in the richest country in the world, we have them all. If you're a veteran or in the Indian Health Service, like these Passamaquoddies we met tonight, for health care purposes, those people live in England. The VA is the beverage model of health care right here in the United States of America. I go to the VA hospital on 9th Street in Denver. It's just like going to the Royal Free Hospital in London. You go there, you wait a long time, you don't get your choice of doctor, the care is great, the doctor works for the government, the nurse works for the government, the lab technician works for the government, and you don't get a bill. This is the beverage model of health care right here in the United States. If you're, as we said, if you're over 65 and on Medicare, well, you live in Canada for health care purposes. That's the Canadian National Health Insurance model. 46 million Americans are on it. It's the most popular. It has the highest rates of satisfaction of any insurance scheme in the United States. If you're a working person sharing the cost of private health insurance with your employer, you live in Germany. That's the Bismarck model of health care. About 150 to 155 million Americans are on it. And if you're one of the, according to the Census Bureau, 50.7 million Americans without health insurance, well, for health care purposes, those people live in Angola or Algeria or Afghanistan. If they have some money in their pocket, they can get treated. If they happen to live in a big city that has a friendly local hospital, they can go down there. If they're really sick, and go to the emergency room and get treated free. And otherwise, they just put up with it. They just live with whatever illness they have. And that's why 25,000 of our fellow Americans die every year of treatable diseases. We've got them all. And we're the only country that does that. All the other countries have decided to put everybody into one system. You know, maybe there's a country that likes big government like Sweden or Denmark or the UK. Everybody is in that beverage model. If it's a capitalist country, Germany, Switzerland, Japan, everybody is in the Bismarck model. They don't have 9 different systems like we do. In Canada, Australia, Taiwan, South Korea, everybody, not just seniors, but everybody is in the Medicare model of health care. Everybody's covered by the same model. So why would you want to do that? Why would you want to? I mean, that's one-size-fits-all medicine, right? Aren't people different? Shouldn't we have different systems? So I went around the world and asked everybody, prime ministers, health ministers, doctors, patients, hospital managers, why do you do that? Why would you want to have everybody in the same system? And I'll tell you their answers, and you can assess whether this makes sense to you. In the first place, if everybody's in the same system, if there's one set of forms and one set of rules and usually one set of prices for the whole country, it's just vastly simpler and therefore vastly cheaper. And as a matter of fact, a major reason, according to Nobel laureate Paul Krugman, the main reason we spend more than anybody else on healthcare is because of the enormous administrative costs of our overlapping crazy quilt system with costs shifted among 50 different payers. And, you know, a hospital has 70, 100 people just doing the billing. Any hospital administrators here, eat your heart out. I went to this 550-bed hospital in Canada. That's a pretty big hospital. It'd be a big hospital in Maine, wouldn't it? It'd be a big hospital in Colorado. And the guy's president of the hospital showing me around, you know, here's this, and very proud of his new hospital. And I said, hey, where's the billing office? And this hospital president gets all embarrassed, you know. And turns out in a 500-bed hospital in Canada, the billing office is 2 part-timers who come in the last 2 days of the month. That's it. Anybody here running a hospital like that? And one of them, her full-time job was billing American tourists who were in town and broke their leg. And this woman says to me, you know, your insurance companies, they never pay. Yeah, we know that. Anybody here think of France as a paradigm of management efficiency? According to McKinsey and Company, if we had the administrative costs of the French healthcare system, we would save $600 billion a year that would cover all the uninsured if we could just get rid of the waste and the paperwork of our complicated system. And you get that if everybody's in, okay? Here's another reason. If everybody's in the same system, cradle to grave, then that system has an economic incentive to practice preventive health, what we might call public health or preventive medicine. Here's the thing about preventive medicine. It's a good thing. It eliminates suffering. It fends off disease. It extends lives. It saves money. But it costs a lot, and you don't get any benefit from it for years or decades. You stop a 17-year-old today from smoking, it would have been 30 years before she got lung cancer, if you follow me. It takes a long time to get the benefit. Are you with me? In a system like the one in the United States, where the average customer is with an insurance company 4.8 years, then you go to a new job or a new plan or you lose your insurance or whatever, our companies, they have to pay an investor a profit to their investors every quarter. It's not in their interest to spend money to keep you healthy. By the time you get sick, you're the next guy's problem, or, you know, in many cases, you're Medicare's problem. Whereas if everybody's in cradle to grave, they want to keep you healthy. Now, in my book, I argue that the world champion of preventive medicine is Great Britain. I don't know how many people here have lived in Britain, but you walk down the street in Britain and there's a big billboard. It says, hey, do your feet hurt? If your feet hurt, call this 800 number and we'll send a podiatrist to your house for free. Well, of course, it's free. It's all free. And the reason for that, of course, is foot pain can be an indicator of diabetes or other serious diseases. Let's get it early and treat people, extend their lives, and save some money. I had it back in the day when I worked for the Washington Post in London, not that long ago either. That was when newspapers still had money, and I had this wonderful office in Mayfair, the nicest part of London, and kind of set a standard for me. After I had that office, I told the Washington Post, from now on, if I don't have a big chandelier and a fireplace, I'm not doing it, because that's what I had in London. And it was right near Oxford Street, which is their Fifth Avenue. You know, it's where all the fancy boutiques are. And I used to go up for lunch and walk down Oxford Street. And you walk down Oxford Street in London in October or November, and you see this very un-British thing, very just not British at all. A bunch of pretty young women in cheerleader outfits. You know, the pleated skirt and a letter sweater and pom-poms. This is not British. They don't do that. They watch Friday Night Lights, you know, so they've seen it in our movies, and they like this look. They find it very sexy, you know. So do I. I always liked it. And so I'm walking down the street, and here, amazingly, in the middle of London, are these kids in American-style cheerleader outfits. And I walk up to this pretty young woman and say, "What are you cheering for?" And she waves her pom-poms at me, you know. Says, "Have you had your flu jab? Have you had a flu shot? It's October." No, I haven't gotten around to that yet. She says, "Go right in that door behind me. It's free." Of course it's free. It's all free, and it saves them money over time because they have an interest. And I when I lived in London, I got to know Tony Blair's health minister, a guy named John Reed, a Scot, probably my cousin. And I said to him once, "You know, I really like living in your country because I feel that a whole bunch of intelligent, dedicated people in your health ministry spend their whole day keeping me and my family healthy, and I'm grateful to you for that." And John Reed says, oh, you needn't thank me. You needn't thank me. He says, "Isn't it obvious? Isn't it obvious why I do that?" And to him, it is obvious why he does it. "No, tell me why." And here's what he said. He said, "You know, in our system, from the minute the line turns blue on your mother's pregnancy test, until the minute you flatline in my hospital 90 years later, you're my patient. Of course I want to keep you healthy." Do you hear what I'm saying? That's an economic incentive to spend money on preventive care. And if everybody's in, you get that incentive. Oh, I'm out of time here. The third reason why you want everybody in, and they all agree on this, because in the other countries, they think it's fairer. They think it's fairer if everybody has the same access to the same care at the same cost. Fairer. What do you think about that? Now, I told you before, I'm trying to be frank here. I'm trying to be an objective reporter. I'll tell you what's good and what's bad about these systems. But when you get to a word like fair or decent or just or humane or ethical, man, that's not objective reporting anymore. Those are subjective judgments. What's fair? What's right to do for your fellow citizens? What's ethical? Those are subjective judgments, and in the end, they're moral judgments. What's right to do for your fellow citizens is a moral decision. And you know what? This is the most important lesson I learned spending your money going around the world. Every country's healthcare system reflects that country's basic moral values. You can't design a healthcare system for any country unless you understand its fundamental moral considerations. If you decide as a moral obligation that your country ought to provide healthcare to everybody who's sick, once you make that commitment, then you can design a system like the ones I saw in Germany and Switzerland and Japan and South Korea and Australia and Canada, Britain, where they cover everybody. If you don't make the moral commitment to cover everybody, well, then you probably end up with a system where some people get the finest health care in the world and the finest hospitals with no waiting, and 50.7 million people barely get in the door until they're sick enough to go to the emergency room. In other words, if you don't make the moral commitment to cover everybody, you end up with the American healthcare system. And that's where we stand today. And we're still not there. Even with this very ambitious, expensive reform, we still haven't gotten to universal coverage. So here's what I'm going to do for you. I know you're busy. You probably don't have time to read my book. You could still buy it. Christmas is coming. Because I'm a nice fella, I'm going to summarize my book for you in one sentence, okay? If we Americans, if we could find the political will to provide health care for everybody, if we could find the will to provide universal coverage, the other rich countries can show us the way. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very much. Let's just open it up for a couple questions, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
We know it's late, but we'd like to make it possible for a couple of questions. So anyone have a question for Tom?
The German system sounded great, but you talked about insurance being provided through employers. What do you do about people who are unemployed or unemployable?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So in those Bismarck model countries, they think it's extremely important that if you lose your job, you keep your health insurance. In fact, I've always felt one of the cruelest of the many bizarre, cruel aspects of our healthcare system is that when you lose your job and you most need health insurance, you lose it in our country. It's ridiculous. But in those countries, you lose your job, or if you don't have a job, the government plays the role of the employer and pays the employer's share of the premium. In most Bismarck countries, the premium is set as a percentage of your income. It's usually about 7.5 or 8%, very close to what we pay in Social Security tax. And so if you have very little income or none, you pay just about zero, and the government makes up the rest of the premium. But the important consideration is you don't take away people's health insurance when they've lost a job, and the government steps in. They're working on the theory that eventually you're going to find another job, which is, you know, it's not always true in Europe these days, but that's the theory. So in those Bismarck countries, government steps in and picks up the role.
Thank you. One other question. Anybody else?
Here we are.
Right here. Roger.
So also in Germany, how do the insurance companies function and compete in terms of providing service to those who are insured and making money?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So how do the insurance companies, it's private insurance, as I said, how do they work in these Bismarck countries? This is important for Americans, I think, because the argument in my book is, look, if we wanted to do it that way, we could cover everybody at reasonable cost in the private sector. Germany does it, Japan does it, Switzerland does it. Here's what they do. They regulate the hell out of the insurance companies, is what they do, in a way that we never have. So in those countries, the insurers are required to cover everybody, no pre-existing condition. And the corollary of that is everybody has to have insurance. Those two go together. In every other country, everybody getting insurance and guaranteed issue, that's like 2 plus 2 equals 4. It's only the United States that didn't figure that out until last March. They have to cover everybody. They have to pay every claim. They don't have hundreds of thousands of underwriters turning down claims because they have to pay any claim certified by a doctor or a hospital or a chiropractor or a healer, whoever it happens to be. They have to pay pretty fast. In France, where everything is done through an electric card, through a digital card, about 90% of all health insurance claims are paid on the same day you go to the doctor. Anybody have that deal here in Maine? Get this, Switzerland is a federalist country, so each canton, each state does things differently. But in many parts of Switzerland, if the health insurance company doesn't pay your claim, both to the doctor and the patient, within 5 days, next month's premium is free. Anybody got that deal here? And there are strict limits on their administrative costs. Our American insurance companies have paperwork costs, salaries, bonuses, marketing, training, all that stuff, that run from about 20 to 35% of every premium dollar, doesn't buy anybody any health care because they go to paperwork. In those countries, this is limited to about 4 or 5%. And finally, all the other countries that have private insurance have decided that health insurance can't be a profit-making enterprise. The last one that allowed for-profit health insurance was Switzerland, and they ended it in 1994, and here's why. When Switzerland had for-profit health insurance, their insurance companies started looking across at our guys, you know, at WellPoint, United Health, Aetna, and adopted some of their practices. If you have to make a profit on health insurance, then what you quickly decide is the last thing you want to do is pay a claim. And this is why our health insurers refuse to cover anybody who's ever been sick. I mean, those people might make a claim. We wouldn't want that. Our health insurers have hundreds of thousands of underwriters whose full-time job is finding reasons to deny your claim. Other countries don't allow that. And, of course, they take a long, long time to pay. And they do that because they don't want to pay claims. They want to pay a dividend to their investors. Other countries have decided that's a fundamental conflict, and therefore in all the other countries that have private insurance, insurers are not allowed to make a profit on the basic coverage. You know, they sell supplemental plans for Botox or hair replacement. They can make a profit on that. And guess what? They do compete. Those companies in Germany, 220 of them, as I said, they're ferociously competitive. And the reason is the more members you have, the more pay the executives get. So they have an interest in building up their customer base. And they compete on that basis. They don't compete to make a profit. In fact, in almost every country, if an insurance company ends the year with a surplus or a margin, we would call that profit, right? They have to redistribute it to the other companies that lost money that year. And the result is every bill gets paid. Every bill gets paid pretty rapidly, but it's heavily regulated in a way our insurers never have accepted. But it's private. It's a private system, and it works. And that's why I argue in my book, look, these single-payer systems I saw, they work fine. Medicare works really well if you're willing to put a little money into it, which the Canadians aren't. But these all private systems, these Bismarck model systems, work fine if you regulate the payer. Thanks so much for listening to me. I'm really grateful to you.
You've been listening to T.R. Reid speaking on national healthcare reform at a recent event in Portland, sponsored by the Daniel Hanley Center for Health Leadership, the Aligning Forces for Quality Partnership, and the World Affairs Council of Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can access it online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.